So welcome to A Correction Podcast. I'm your host, Lev Moskow. And today we are joined by a very, very special guest, my good friend, my neighbor, and my colleague, Harry Fader, who has been teaching for, what is it, Harry? Is it 18 years?
Oh, God. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
So today we're talking to Harry, one, because he's one of the best history teachers I know, but also because he was a lawyer and he was a fantastic lawyer before he went into teaching. And we're going to be talking about civic participation, the state of our democracy, and the legal system today. And I couldn't think of a better guest. So welcome to the show, Harry Fader.
Well, thank you, Lev. It's a pleasure to be here. I've always, one of my goals in life was to be a guest on A Correction Podcast. And you know, so now if I die tomorrow, it won't be so bad.
I really hope you don't die for a long
I'm
time.
I'm joking.
The first question we're going to talk about is a lawsuit that was filed in November of 2018 by 14 plaintiffs who are high school students who sued the state of Rhode Island. The case was Cook versus Raimondo. Mm-hmm. And I understand that you worked a bit on this case, and I was hoping maybe you could talk about it a bit.
Yeah, sure. I worked on it a little bit. The credit for this case should go principally to a guy named Michael Rebell, who teaches at Teachers College. And before he brought this case, he brought a case in New York State that you're probably familiar with, the case on behalf of the Campaign for Fiscal Equity. Which was a state case about funding in the state of New York and challenging the funding formula in New York, that how they fund schools, how the state funds schools, trying to force the state to produce a more equitable funding formula. So he's got a sort of, well-trained lawyer, and he's got a long history of this. I, when I was on sabbatical, was sitting in on a graduate class he was teaching that was half Columbia law students and half students in the graduate program and the PhD program at Teachers College in like school politics or whatever it's called. And so the whole sort of theory of the lawsuit basically takes, its emanation point from a Supreme Court case called San Antonio versus Rodriguez, decided in 1973. It's sort of like the tail end of the Warren Court. And Rodriguez basically poured cold water on the notion that there was a federal right to a kind of minimum education. It was a challenge that came out of Texas that basically said that mostly Latino students, that they weren't getting an adequate education. They weren't being, there were a lot of inequities and disparities in the education they were getting in Texas. And the Supreme Court said, that this may be so, but there's nothing in the federal constitution that guarantees you a right to even a minimum basic education. But they left a little door open in the opinion, which basically said the facts here don't rise to the level of a constitutional violation, but there may be a case down the road that would produce such facts that if perhaps kids were so denied an education that it would not enable them to exercise their other basic constitutional rights, like the right to vote, like the right to serve on a jury. And so this case that was brought in Rhode Island was basically an attempt to kind of relitigate San Antonio versus Rodriguez. And Michael's idea and his theory, which was brought to fruition in this litigation, was that civics education, that education about our democracy, that civic experiences, things even as far as like extracurricular activities like debate or Model UN, things like that, learning about the Constitution, all of that kind of stuff is necessary for our democracy and for individuals to be able to exercise their basic rights as citizens. And that Rhode Island, in a variety of schools, in a variety of ways, had denied students all of these opportunities. They weren't getting, because of, in part because of the emphasis on minimum basic education. They weren't getting the kind of education that young people need in order to be active citizens in our democracy, to serve on juries. One part of the complaint alleges that it violates the Republican Government Clause of Article 4 of the Constitution, because if you don't have people who, you know what to base their vote on, you can't really have a Republican form of government. We, when we were in the seminar, talked about maybe we should throw in a First Amendment claim that people can't exercise political speech adequately if they don't have sort of some basic ideas about how the government is run, et cetera. You know, the other interesting thing, and this is frequently how these kind of impact litigations work, is, you know, Rhode Island was sort of a choice made. There were people in Rhode Island who were interested in bringing the suit, particularly there. And I know a part of the suit alleges that the Spanish-speaking community, the ELLs in the state, are really being underserved. But there were other states that were interested in pursuing this litigation as well. I remember we were looking at Illinois, we were looking at Florida at one point, we're looking at Arizona. But Rhode Island, both geographically and because of the people on the ground in Rhode Island who really wanted to pursue the lawsuit, was basically chosen as the kind of test case. And what's interesting about the opinion that you talk about is, you know, Cook, the plaintiffs lost, but they lost with an opinion that, you know, any lawyer who loses at the trial court level would die for an opinion like this, because it basically agrees with the plaintiff. And then he said, but the judge said, but my hands are tied because of San Antonio versus Rodriguez. And this is a district court in Rhode Island. And so he can't violate what is clear Supreme Court precedent. That's for future appeals courts. So that's where the lawsuit stands. And it was a lawsuit that, you know, you're almost better off losing at the trial court level in order to establish the principle, even though that doesn't help the particular plaintiffs right now.
And do you imagine that this case or a case like this will make it to the Supreme Court someday?
It might. You know, there's another case that was in the Sixth Circuit, came out of Michigan, that was a slightly different argument. And it argued that there, the argument was that the kids, you know, weren't getting like a basic minimum education that provided for their literacy. And the Sixth Circuit, actually, a panel of, which is like one level up from a district court, a panel of three judges agreed with the plaintiffs in that case. I think it's the Gary M or Gary P case, agreed with the plaintiffs and said, you know, they haven't been given enough of an education. We see that language in San Antonio versus Rodriguez. This is the case that they were talking about. But what happened then, it was appealed to the full Sixth Circuit, and that's called an en banc proceeding. You know, lawyers like Latin, so they use words like en banc. The en banc proceeding, but before the en banc panel could hear it, the party settled. So that case sort of, but the last opinion in that case is effectively an opinion that says that the plaintiffs win and that Michigan did not give enough of an education to these kids in a manner that violated their due process and equal protection rights. So you could imagine a scenario where the First Circuit basically agrees with the district court in Rhode Island, and then a good constitutional Supreme Court lawyer will say, "Eureka, there's a circuit split here. The Sixth Circuit has said that you do have a right to some sort of minimum basic education. The First Circuit says that you don't have a right. This is something the Supreme Court should revisit." So it could, but I've got to say, I think that in the Supreme Court, the chances of either of these cases winning might be small, given the lack of the appetite of the federal courts to really kind of wade into this sort of education policy, if you will.
We sit here on the eve of the 2020 election, and in 2016, 55% of eligible voters cast a vote. I got a pretty simple question for you. It's a big question, but well, actually two parts. First, is our democracy broken? And
yes.
Okay. And then, well, that's easy.
And yeah,
then
that's
what,
it.
And then what role do the courts play in breaking it?
Oh boy. Well, I, you know, they play a lot. Let me just say, take a step back. I'll answer the court's question, but I think it part of our sort of brokenness is not, it should not be laid at the feet of the courts. You know, the courts, they perhaps regulate our politics and allow the people in political office and political power and voters to do certain things, or they don't police it adequately. But sort of the impulse to suppress the vote does not come initially, let's say, from the courts. You know, in our current system, or in our in this cycle of elections, it mostly comes from the Republican Party. Almost all of it comes from the Republican Party. So I want to just say, and also, you know, the problems with our education system and the inadequate learning that is happening, inadequate learning, but the types of learning and the mode of education. You know, we don't educate kids for democracy. When we do education well, it's mostly an economic and technical education that allows people to, if you will, you know, succeed in the workplace. And that's been, I would say, the driving force behind our education system. So we've sort of like ignored this idea of educating for democracy. I mean, it goes back to, you know, a little bit to Horace Mann. It really goes back to Dewey, the turn of the last century in the progressive era, that education and that the common school and beyond is really given the way the world, I mean, it really goes back to Jefferson, I should say. Because he says, you know, you can't really have a democracy without an educated electorate. So there are all sorts of problems in our polity that shouldn't land at the feet of the courts. Now, let me go back.
So wait, before you answer the question then about the courts, because this is another question I wanted to ask.
Okay.
But now, you know, imagine Biden wins and he makes you education secretary, you know, what changes do you suggest right away with thinking about how we build, you know, the good citizen?
Wow. That's a fabulous question. You know, I think it is an approach that is, you know, is multi-layered. First of all, you know, we have to add, you know, I'll go back to a book by the great Ted Sizer called Horace's Compromise. And Ted Sizer, for your listeners who don't know, was the dean of the Graduate School of Harvard at Harvard. He was a professor at Brown for a long time. And he was one of the co-founders with Debbie Meyer of the Coalition of Essential Schools. And so what I would say that we need to do is sort of think about an education broadly, philosophically, that enables young people to both sort of actualize their potential and sort of think about what they're good at, what they might like to do, and then also to imbue them in the values of the democracy and give them not just democratic knowledge, but democratic experience to have them engage in, from the youngest ages, in conversations, because democracy is ultimately about negotiation and conversation. It's not just about learning what the Constitution says. In order to actualize the promise of the Declaration of Independence, of freedom and equality, and to actualize the hopes of the founders, even though that their world was very limited to white property owners, we know that. But as it has expanded, if we want to build a multiracial democracy, I think what education needs to look like is to say that the classroom is a place where kids are talking to one another. And how do we build those structures to enable those kind of conversations to happen? And also, when we talk about civics education, it's not merely about, you know, as I said, like learning from a textbook. It's about exploring the history, warts and all. It's sort of what Jill Lepore talks about this in her recent book, in her recent sort of you know, I'll call it a textbook, but it's not a classical textbook, called These Truths, that history is a process of investigation and of inquiry. And so what we need to do is have our schools engage in that process of investigation and inquiry. Now, you know, this is true in history. It's true when examining literature. It's also true in science and mathematics as well. I mean, part of our problem right now is that a good third of the country doesn't trust science. And I think that stems from something we haven't done well in our system of education. So if I were education secretary, I would say the things that we have to fund is a professional, you know, teaching force that enables the people running the classrooms to run these kind of discussions, to engage in these kind of conversations with kids. And then to have, you know, structurally to sort of rethink a lot of the testing and standards driven mandates that we've seen coming since No Child Left Behind, but it even extends beyond it. You know, our education system sort of goes through these cycles where we say, oh, we're failing. And then the answer is not to, you know, let the professionals, as they do in a place like Finland, develop systems of education that actually produce, as you would say, good citizens, but rather they say, well, you know, we're gonna have this test and we'll see how well they do versus this external measure. And what that does is give obviously incentive to just sort of teach to a test as opposed to have this kind of creativity and discussion in the classroom. I mean, we could go on about this for a long time, and I haven't given you sort of very specific policy proposals because I don't think I'm going to be made Secretary of Education. But I certainly, you know, would look at some people like Linda Darling Hammond and others who, you know, would say, here's what we would certainly like get rid of the last vestiges of No Child Left Behind. There's the whole issue of charters, which we could talk about, and privatization. But I don't know that you want to sort of wade into that place right now.
Yeah, I think that's a different direction.
Yeah.
And I think you've done a good job, but I guess I do want to hold your feet to the fire a little bit, because I know what inquiry is and what a good inquiry education looks like, but I suppose mm-hmm. many of our listeners do not. So at the level of policy, besides saying I want our teachers to do inquiry and I want mm-hmm. our kids to stop taking so many darn tests, mm-hmm. you know, what would one piece of policy look like? Maybe our first piece of policy to set the ball in motion.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, first, I think the thing about inquiry and that kind of education is you need talented teachers, right? So you need teachers who know how to run a classroom. You need teachers who know to ask questions. Now, teachers can be trained to do these kinds of things when the system supports that kind of training. So I think what I would really start with is how, and you know, obviously you sort of got to get that. You got to work with the teachers unions, and you have to work with school systems, because, you know, when we go back to one of the reasons that San Antonio versus Rodriguez was decided the way it is because we have a tradition of local control, state and local control of our education systems here. So what you can do at the federal level is weirdly limited, but what you can do is create programs, create incentives for states, just like we create incentives for them to, you know, meet their adequate yearly progress, create incentives for states to train and pay and professionalize teachers. So I think that's where I would really start. This problem isn't going to be fixed, you know, in 3 years. This is, you have to think about, like Finland did a long time ago, you have to think about this as a 10 and 20 year project to essentially, you know, change the way teachers think about the way they, you know, quote unquote, deliver their services. I'll use a sort of business economics term. And so I would start there with grants and incentives to get state and local governments to value inquiry teaching. And then it kind of has sort of a grassroots bubbling up. Then from the top, then the question becomes, what do you measure? So if you're not measuring, let's say, you know, if your history regents, like we have in New York, doesn't measure whether or not you necessarily, you know the reasons behind the Mexican-American War, but rather if you sort of frame questions differently about what do historians say, how do we look at what one historian says versus another historian about the causes of the Mexican-American War and what the president was thinking at the time and why we went into it in 1848 or whatever. If you change the way you assess to a what we call performance-based assessments and have kids writing papers, having kids critiquing other kids' work, having kids engaging in Socratic seminars. Now, obviously, I'm talking about at the high school level, but before that, there's a lot of work that can be done with younger kids to sort of prepare them for this kind of, you know, higher level inquiry-based thinking. So I definitely think we have to start with the teachers and then have those professionals developing a kind of inquiry-based, thinking-based, you know, lessons, for want of a better word, that would be implemented in the classroom. I mean, a really great example of this is, you know, the Performance Standards Consortium, the New York Performance Standards Consortium, that we are all a part, that Beacon, that school we teach at, is a part of, where this has been at a small level, really. It's sort of a drop in the bucket when you think about it. I mean, this has been the work for 20, 25 years. There are other networks of such schools. There's the Deeper Learning Network, which is really out in California. So there are places where this is happening. It's not happening. But I got to tell you, if you go to your sort of average school anywhere in America, you don't get a lot of this. You still get a lot more drill and kill, and that just sort of sucks the joy out of learning from kids, and it makes them just want to be on their phone, you know. Which, I mean, playing Among Us is it may be a lovely game, but I don't know that it necessarily. I mean, they talk to each other, so maybe it does build some democratic skills, especially in the pandemic when people can't be in a room together. But the bottom line is that's, I think, the direction we need to go in terms of training teachers, funding that kind of work. We don't fund that kind of work. We give money to places that produce good test scores, and those are perverse incentives.
Yeah, and speaking of incentives, to go back to the election a little bit, there's very little incentive for most voters to be what political scientists call highly informed, or frankly, even to vote. There are a lot better ways, and even more impactful ways to spend your time. And I'm wondering what it would mean to even be informed. What would it take to build an informed citizenry?
Well, I think you know, at the first level, you have to get people interested in their own communities, and to have it so that from a young age, kids feel like they have voice and impact in their communities. So, you know, I think like when we do this well at our school, now, obviously, we have sort of a mix of kids. We have some kids who are sort of middle class kids. We have some kids who are more working class kids. But, you know, when kids are out there at a variety of levels, if they like go and like work for their local city councilman, or, you know, to sort of see democracy in action. So that's sort of one level you get kids engaged in. Even if they're like on their block and they're doing like a cleanup drive or a book drive, you know, it sort of goes back to what de Tocqueville saw what was so great about America, you know, back in the 1830s, is that it's all about the local action. What makes Americans democratic? You know, yes, back then we didn't have the class divide in quite the same way we have now. It was pre-industrial revolution. It was certainly pre-tech. So you don't have these wealth disparities. So that's, you know, one thing. I mean, we certainly need a little more economic democracy. And without that economic democracy, people just won't feel like, why should I bother? Right, it's hard enough for me to put food on the table. I need to participate in democracy too. Mark Zuckerberg tells me what democracy is. What am I going to say about that? There's nothing I can say. So obviously, there was an economic component to it. But in terms of how you get people to sort of participate, you know, I think it really does have to start at the local grassroots level with kids. I mean, even when they sort of go and they work at a shelter or something like that, just so they feel involved in the community. So I think it's those democratic experiences. It's the democratic knowledge. I mean, people should understand how the levers of government work, certainly, and where they fit in those levers of government, and that, you know, voting matters, and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So it's these democratic experiences, these democratic knowledge, they need practice. So even in the school, when the school itself functions as a more democratic place, things like student government, things like the debate team, Model UN, you know, those are the kind of, and, you know, I'm not inventing this stuff up. There've been plenty of studies about this. And a lot of one of the things like Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, a lot of judges, appeals court judges have set up these programs to try to create these kind of civic, internal civic experiences or civic-like democratic experiences. So you have them within the school, you get them in your community, and then you sort of feel like you're a part of some kind of a democratic process. And before you become an adult who has all sorts of lunch pail and put bread on the table responsibilities. I mean, sadly, a lot of kids have those for their families too. You know, you already are imbued with this idea that I'm a part of something greater as well. And I have say in, certainly at a minimum, in my local community. And then finally, in the big thing, in the presidential election, yeah, it's a small voice, but collectively, that voice matters. I don't know if that's an answer.
That's certainly an answer. It's a good answer. I want to now go back to this question of our broken democracy. And mm-hmm. I asked you before, what role courts play in breaking our democracy?
Let's just start from the first premise, that the courts, federal courts, right, are not a democratic institution. Right? You don't elect federal judges. If at best, they are the dead hand of ancient democracies, right? So you have justices on the Supreme Court who were put there by a president and a Senate from 30 years ago. In fact, they are designed to be counter-majoritarian, right? So to say that the courts are part of our democracy in and of itself is a false statement. The courts are designed to sort of protect the individual at best, right? Or to protect the system and to conserve, and I'll use that word, the system from, at times, the tyranny of true democracy, right? Because if you give the courts the power of judicial review, right, which since Marbury versus Madison, that is a power that has been asserted by the courts, meaning that they can look at a law that was passed democratically and say either that it violates some right, and thus we as the arbiters of what the Constitution means, reject that law on behalf of a few people who have brought this lawsuit and the people that they represent. So we are going to reject what, you know, sometimes a very popular majority in the legislature has actually passed. And we saw this in the New Deal when for a little while, right? A lot of the New Deal programs were overturned by the Supreme Court, not because it violated anybody's rights, but because it violated what the Constitution said about the power of Congress and the federal government. Even like the early antitrust law, enforcement of the antitrust laws, you know, in the 1890s and early 1900s, the Supreme Court kind of took a lot of the guts out of the antitrust law by interpreting it, the Commerce Clause, in a way that said, you know, the federal government actually doesn't have the power to reach this stuff, right? Including things we take for granted, you know, now, like the national minimum wage. I mean, originally, the U.S., when it was first suggested as part of the progressive era, the Supreme Court actually said, no, you can't do that because you don't have the power to do that. And furthermore, it violates people's like right and freedom of the contract. So in the beginning of the 20th century, there was a whole anti-democratic action by the Supreme Court to say, I know you want all these progressive legislation, but actually it hurts an individual's right to pursue their business or to earn wages or thing, you know, there was this idea that the due process clause, substantive, and sometimes these are called like the Lochner era of cases. Lochner versus New York was a decision in 1905 where the Supreme Court overturned New York State's laws that governed the health and sanitary elements of underground bakeries in New York City, mostly in New York City, although I guess they were statewide. And you know, they said, you can't do that because if the bakers want to work 15 hours a day, you got to let them work 15 hours a day. Now, is that anywhere in the Constitution? No, but they found this in the freedom of contract. So, you know, and in an interesting way, even Roe versus Wade, right, is sort of and could be argued as an anti-democratic, if you think that, let's say, the state of Louisiana, if it went and banned abortion, that represented the majority opinion of the people of Louisiana. Now, obviously, we blanch at that, or many of us, because that interferes with a woman's right to her body. So, you know, we have to sort of be careful when we wade into the waters of what do we let the court do? Because in theory, interpreting substantive due process the way the court did in Lochner and the court did in Roe is kind of intellectually consistent, even though there are distinctions to be made between the, you know, freedom of contract and a woman's right body. So courts are anti and are designed to be anti-majoritarian. Now, they've impacted our democracy lately in sort of some very direct ways by making it easier to undertake voter suppression, by overturning the will of Congress in the Shelby County case, when they basically said, look, I know you Congress, or whatever the vote was in the Senate, 98-2, voted to reauthorize Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act basically said that if a district has some history of discrimination or a state any time in the past, that if they want to change their election system or redraw lines in a way that negatively impacts or dilutes minority voting, that all of their new plans have to be pre-cleared with the Justice Department. So that means that an individual doesn't have to like sue every time a state does something screwy. And the Supreme Court said, well, you know, this is unfair because it was passed in 1965 and this is 2014 and the country's a different place. And, you know, you can't show the record of Congress doesn't show that there's the same level of discrimination. But what the Supreme Court basically did is substitute their own judgment for Congress. And that is both counter-majoritarian from the standpoint of the action of the Supreme Court and winds up being anti-democratic, because what happens after Shelby County? All of these voter suppression policies, laws, making it harder to vote, suddenly come out of the woodwork. Why? Because now in order to get rid of them, you have to go lawsuit by lawsuit by lawsuit by lawsuit, and that's a lot harder. So that's one way. Another place where the Supreme Court has done some bad things is in campaign financing. And, you know, again, here it starts out as the preservation of a right, right? So after Watergate, we passed these campaign finance laws and established the Federal Election Commission. And so the case went to the Supreme Court challenging these restrictions on campaign spending. Case is Buckley versus Vallejo. And in the Buckley case, Supreme Court says, you know, we have a First Amendment here. And if you want to spend money to get elected, right, that's speech. That's your political speech. You can spend all the money you want. So if Mike Bloomberg wants to spend $1 billion to win American Samoa, he can spend $1 billion to win American Samoa, no matter what it does to our democracy. But we understand that it's still okay to have limits on your campaign contributions because there's a direct relationship to the money you give to a candidate and the potential corruption of that candidate. So even though you have a First Amendment right to give money to a candidate, that's sort of outweighed by the government's interest in stopping corruption, in the quid pro quo of corruption. Now, you know, very clever people who like to control our politics with money said, well, you know what? That's fine. We'll just set up these things called PACs and super PACs. And we'll just like throw a lot of money and advocate for an issue. Now, of course, the issue sub rosa supports a particular candidate. And so it was a way to get around the limitations on contributions. Then the Congress passes another law that is supported by the people, the McCain-Feingold law, that says that tries to sort of eliminate some of the super PAC and PAC money. That is challenged in the Citizens United case. Here's another example. You ask how the Supreme Court undermines democracy. Citizens United, the Supreme Court says, hey, you're a corporation like a person has the right to speak. And furthermore, if a corporation wants to spend $50 million to advocate generally for candidates that support the oil industry or that support the tech industry or whatever, they're allowed to do that. Why? Because they have a First Amendment right to do it. As long as it's not coordinated with the campaign, because we know if it's coordinated with the campaign, that's a corruption problem. Of course, what this does is sort of open up the floodgates to all this money. And in this election cycle, we spent $11 billion, you know, on elections. And obviously you asked, like, how do we get people to be engaged in the system? You know, if somebody sees that millions and millions of dollars are being given to influence our system of voting and our system of democracy, why would you think that you have any say? And so, you know, there are other countries where they cap the amount, like Canada, where they cap the amount that any candidate can actually spend in a given election cycle. We can't do that because of what the Supreme Court has said about the First Amendment and money. So there's just sort of a few examples of how the court actually, I would argue, has subverted democracy by, and, you know, I'll tell you, if the Supreme Court gets rid of Obamacare, right? There's another way it subverted democracy. Obamacare was passed by a majority in Congress. It's popular. It's giving people, you know, their health care, whether you think it's the perfect system or not. If the Supreme Court says, well, actually, you know, it violates due process or it is beyond their Commerce Clause power to do, that undercuts the power of the people to engage in the kind and to get their representatives to engage in the kind of legislation that benefits us all. And I will say, you know, a lot of lawyers like my age who sort of went to law school, I went to law school like in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, we were sort of still breathing the air of the Warren Court, the one time in American history, right, that the court was sort of viewed as a progressive force. But every other moment of American history, the court has been the brake on popular majority, not the expander of individual rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we could go one step above the court.
Yeah.
I'm wondering to what extent are our problems due to, or to what extent is the problem our Constitution itself? Mm.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, certainly, you know, the Senate is not a democratic body. I mean, let's be clear. So, you know, I sort of teach the Constitution a lot with my kids and the origin of the Constitution. I mean, it was specifically designed to protect state power. In many ways, it was designed to protect the power of the South, which is, of course, slaveholder power at that moment. So, you know, there is a, and I'll say this, you know, there is a certain racist quality to the Senate in its origin. Now, it was, you know, the political theorists will tell you it was the cooling waters on the mob. But now, you know, when Wyoming has the same two senators as California, right, the person in which, and I think Wyoming's population is whatever it is, 500,000 people, and California's is like 50 million people. I'm probably getting the numbers a little wrong. But that is not democracy, right? Because and it's funny because at every other level of government, based on a series of cases that come out of the Warren Court, like Baker versus Carr and Reynolds versus Sims, like they got rid of that. New York City used to be run by something called the Board of Estimate, where every borough president had a vote on land use decisions. The Supreme Court says, Oh, yeah. So it used to be the mayor had like three votes, or if I forget, four votes. The city council president had a vote when the city council president, that was the only power of the city council, really, was the city council president's. And I'm not going back too far. I'm going back to until the late 80s, right? When the Supreme Court declared the Board of Estimate unconstitutional and we had a New York City charter revision, right? So the problem was that Brooklyn and Staten Island both had one vote on the Board of Estimate. Now, what's the problem there, Mr. Moscow? You know that Brooklyn
Staten
has a lot.
Much bigger than Brooklyn.
Right? What? Brooklyn's much bigger than Staten
Not
Island.
Not joking, yeah.
Yes. But anyway, now in the Senate, we tolerate this because in order to get rid of that, we have to. Now, you know, it was a great thing during the progressive era. And by the way, the senators used to be not even elected by the people of the state. They used to be like sent there by the state legislatures. So they were even more removed from the people until whatever it was, 1917, 1918, when the constitutional amendment, you know, as part of the progressive era. I mean, my hope is, by the way, that we're entering a new progressive era, that a lot of these anti, because, you know, there was sort of the federal income tax is another thing. We had a wave of, and of course, women getting the right to vote in 1920, right? So we had at that moment a wave of pro-democratic reform, institutional reform that altered our basic structure of government. And I think we're due for another one. And look, it may be that in antitrust, you know, the Sherman Act was originally passed in 1890 as part of this, and that's when I talk about economic democracy as being a part of this. I mean, if you have excessive concentration of economic power, you know, you have a democratic problem.
You're sort of optimistic that this may be a new progressive era or the beginnings of a new progressive era.
You know, I think we'll see how this election goes. I mean, I think it could go either way. If the forces, if the federal government is, you know, continues to be run by people who are eroding the various departments of the government, including the Justice Department. Look, Bill Barr's reason for suing Google is because he views it perhaps as a check, you know, big business as a check on his branch of the government, essentially. You know, I teach my kids sometimes, we talk about power in America as being a triangle. You know, there's the power of the government, there's the power of the people, and then there's the power of money. And throughout our history as sort of the power of the corporate, because originally, you know, Hamilton had this idea that it was the job of the government to basically support business, right? That's why he was in favor of the bank, right? One of the first great constitutional crises in our history was Hamilton versus Jefferson about the national bank. And then it extended from Jefferson to Jackson, that the national bank was there because the original national bank was basically not just like it wasn't the Fed, right? It was essentially Goldman Sachs for projects. And so, you know, in addition to being the Fed, or, you know, the precursor to a kind of Federal Reserve. And so it was a really, really powerful institution. You know, Hamilton writes this like report of manufacturers and stuff like that. He viewed it as kind of like the Bank of England, basically creating a manufacturing base or financing a manufacturing base for America. But then business got so big that people in the government's like, whoa, you know, they're so big, they're controlling us. When you get to like the Rockefeller era, and that's where we get, you know, the progressives and the passage of the antitrust laws and things like that. And then the people are sitting, basically their way they exercise their power is by taking to the streets, by not buying the corporation's products, which as we know, we're powerless to do in this tech era. Or by electing people to the representative bodies who will do their bidding for them in terms of passing progressive type legislation. So when our democracy is broken in like so many different directions, like the government is not representative of the people, the government is not doing a good job of breaking up economic power, and the people right now seem to be powerless to deal with that economic power. And so that's why we're kind of in the pickle we're in.
So Harry, to go back to the question of what makes the good citizen, I mean, I think part of any good education, and I know you agree about this because you teach a class for 12th graders on the law and the legal system, is having some sense of how our legal system works. I'm wondering what you hope that the 12th graders who come out of your class learn about law and the legal system, and what you wish all students knew.
Look, I just want to take one step back from that question. And, you know, there are things that kids leave high school without knowing. And I think there are like three things that every citizen will have to deal with, you know, before they die. One is our legal system, because everybody gets married. Everybody has to, like, sometimes they get divorced. Sometimes they're in the criminal justice system. Sometimes they get sued. They certainly buy property, et cetera, right? So one is the legal system. The other is the basic workings of the economy, which goes to what you teach, of course, because everybody is looking for a job. Everybody's an economic actor. The third thing is, you know, people don't know about healthcare and medicine. Right. So a basic understanding of how to talk to your doctor, how to ask your doctor questions, even if you're never a doctor. And those are things we don't generally teach, or they're certainly not required to be taught in high school. So let me talk about the legal system. What I want my kids to understand or to know is they're sort of the substance and the procedure. I want them to understand how the thing works in a way so that they can actually both navigate it and negotiate it as citizens, and to also understand what is sort of good about it and bad about it in a way that doesn't make them cynical, frankly, or excessively cynical. So when we say, and we talk about this, I'm in sort of the part that's talking about criminal justice, and we're about to talk about these stand your ground laws, for example. So to understand how these laws impact the way the criminal justice system works, the racial disparity that happens in terms of the people who actually wind up being victims because of this law, to understand the inequities and the injustices, but also to understand, you know, the rights and the promises of the system, and how there is due process a lot of the time. I think, sadly, a lot of our kids are rightly cynical about systems of justice. And I think, you know, whether you're coming at this from the right or the left, the only way to sort of have kids come to terms with what goes on out there is to have them take a realistic and critical look, and not just have it be, you know, here's what the Constitution says, George Washington was a great man, end of story, right? That you really need to understand and connect how the system works currently, of course, with its history and how it evolved to get there. So I want kids to understand what the social contract entails and what is their place in that social contract. And that is law. And what are our goals for law? So we start that class with a discussion of what is the purpose of a legal system. And we examine the question of justice. Is there some higher morality that we're striving towards? Does, you know, and we talk about Rawls, but does Rawlsian justice even adequately account for the history of white supremacy and race in America? We had a discussion about that, and we did some reading about that. So I want kids to, you know, not only understand that when the cops arrest them, they have to have probable cause, or, you know, when what your Fifth Amendment rights are, that's elemental, but to really understand how the system works, why it works the way it does, and what you can do potentially to change it and to work towards a more idealized notion of justice that also accomplishes our goal of a good ordered society. I think part of what they're seeing is the injustice is creating society that doesn't seem very well ordered. So I would say that is, and to understand how the government works also. And because, you know, you are in a democracy, you are part of that government. And it's not just about voting. It's about having access to power. It's about having access to media. It's about sort of having a voice in your community.